Watson. News Radio 570 WSYR.
Everybody, and welcome to the Weeders Digest on News Radio 570 WSYR. It's just a little bit after 11 o'clock, and we're going to do things a little bit differently today. Every occasionally, I have the opportunity to just sort of sit back and ponder the state of horticulture and gardening and say to myself, you know, there are a number of topics that I want to address, and it's just difficult to address in our normal format. And so today is going to be one of those days, fueled in part by a little bit of a rant I went off on a couple of weeks ago. You may recall there was a front page article in the Post Standard about the better part of a month ago now that talked about soil contaminants here in the immediate city of Syracuse, particularly lead and arsenic, and how these levels were high in these areas where community gardens were being constructed and initiated. And I was not a big fan of the way that article, the tact of that article. I think it was a little bit of sensationalism. The information was partial at best. And then, lo and behold, about a week or week and a half later, there was a big article in the New York Times about that same issue of contaminants in soils where people are having gardens in urban settings. So, I said to myself, self, we need to get to the bottom of this a little bit, and where better to turn than the Waste Management Institute at Cornell University and one of their extension associates, Hannah Shaler. Good morning, Hannah.
Good morning, Terry.
How are you?
I'm doing great.
Good, good. So you heard me sort of set the stage there, I think, and I figured I'd go straight to the source as far as expertise, existing expertise in contaminants in garden settings, as well as forward-thinking or forward-looking expertise, because you and others at the Waste Management Institute are sort of mapping a strategy for getting a better handle than we already have on this whole issue of contaminants in urban soils, correct?
Definitely, and we really appreciate the chance to discuss this today.
Wonderful.
Well, in light of the recent articles.
Yeah, you know, and in fact, the director of is he the director of the Waste Management Institute, Dr. McBride, or is he just, but he's focusing specifically on these contaminant issues, correct?
Dr. McBride became the director about a year ago.
Okay, and so he was actually quoted in the Post or the New York Times article, if I recall correctly.
Yes, he was.
Yeah, okay, so anyway, let's begin sort of at the beginning, if we could, a little bit, and somewhat what's directing my conversation or my thinking here is that I went online to the Waste Management Institute website, and I downloaded one of the new publications that just came out back in April. It's Soil Contaminants and Best Practices for Healthy Gardens. So in a way, that's sort of what I'm working off, what I have in front of me, and I just want to remind our listeners that you can go to our website, 570WSYR.com. You can then click on the shows link, which will trigger a drop-down box. You scroll down to the Weeders Digest, you click on that, and I'll have links, not only for the conversation that we're having with Hannah here, links to the Waste Management Institute and the resources available there, but also for our other guests coming up a little bit later on in the program as well. So I just want to get that out front, that this information will be available and you can access it through the Weeders Digest blog on our website, 570WSYR.com. Okay, now that we've got that out of the way, Hannah, let's start at the beginning. Where do these quote-unquote contaminants come from? And maybe you can explain, these materials, in fact, are in the environment to begin with. It's not like humans put them there necessarily, right?
Exactly. So the first and to remember when we're talking about this is that metals are types of chemical elements, and they occur naturally in soils and in the environment. But human activities can also add more of these metals to the environment than what started there.
Okay. And, go ahead.
So, and I was just going to say, so if we think about urban areas, there's going to be more human activity. We see more buildings, more traffic, more industrial and commercial activity. So urban areas might tend to have higher levels of metals in certain other contaminants as compared to those other areas.
Okay. So, you know, these materials are all around us, and they haven't grown up in northwestern Illinois at one time. It actually was sort of the lead capital of the world. There was lead mines throughout sort of northwestern Illinois, and I would actually, as a kid, sort of wander around in them. They were very cool. But anyway, be that as it may, how do you, well, first off, again, another sort of setting the stage part is my wife and I, we've lived in the city of Syracuse since, for more than 20 years and have gardened in our backyard and never once have given these existing metals a second thought as far as our garden goes. And people have been gardening in Syracuse and throughout the Northeast for hundreds of years. So given that, why is it now such a concern?
Well, one reason is that people are talking about it more and thinking about it more. And as we're talking, thinking about all this, I should also start by reminding everybody that when we're talking about the possibility of contamination and the possibility of health effects, we also want to remember that there's lots of known benefits to gardening. You know, especially in urban areas, it's a great source of exercise, a way to get fresh food, a way to build your community. So we need to keep all that in mind as we're going through this discussion, too.
And in fact, it really does sort of become a matter of a risk-benefit analysis, which, in fact, is one of the other topics we're going to talk about a little bit later on in the program with Dr. Brenda Nordstrom from SUNY ESF, whose specialty is, in fact, environmental risk assessment. So we're going to sort of see if we can't close the loop on this entire conversation. One of the confusing things when these articles came out that I struggled with, it was finding specific data that says, without question, if you find lead levels or arsenic levels or cadmium levels above a certain threshold, that should be cause for concern. I could not find any consensus as far as what, in fact, should be considered abnormal levels of these materials. Is that actually true? Is it all over the board? Or is there somewhere someone can turn for that definitive information just to begin with?
You're exactly right that this is kind of the big, tricky question with all of this, and it's one that many people are continuing to think about and to act on. Currently, there are no clear and consistent recommendations for what levels of contaminants are okay in gardens or in any other residential and community soils, for that matter. There are, however, some resources from the US EPA as well as New York State. They've established guidelines for levels in soils that are used as part of screening for certain programs, for example, Superfund and Brownfield programs. So although these values aren't designed particularly for residents or gardeners to use when they're interpreting their soil test results, the science behind them and the risk assessments behind them can provide some information for us to work from.
Okay.
But you have to be really careful with how you use those values and how you interpret them.
Right.
Because out of context, it can be even more confusing.
Right. And I think that's one of the concerns that I have is that and you alluded to earlier, is there's a lot of people now that are really concerned about gardening in urban areas because of these articles based on incomplete information at best. Let's talk about some of the ways that people, in theory, could potentially be exposed to these materials, and then sort of dissect that a little bit, maybe.
Okay. Contaminants can get into people's bodies in several different ways. A big one is that while people are gardening or working or playing outside, they can accidentally ingest or consume some small amounts of soil. Children are obviously much more likely to do this, and some may even be doing it intentionally, so that's something to definitely watch out for. People may also breathe in soil dust or soil vapors as they're outside or even potentially in their homes. People can also obviously eat food or drink water that may have contaminants on or in them. What's interesting is that with garden plants, it's often not contaminants that are actually in the produce that you're consuming, but it may be the soil dust that's ended up on the plant. If you think about something like leafy vegetables, it could be really difficult to wash all that soil off the plants before you're eating it.
Okay. All right, so we have potential pathways. So we've talked about the potential contaminants in the soil. We talked a little bit about levels, and there's some question as far as, you know, what those levels actually are. We've talked about potential pathways. The next thing becomes, I guess, really sort of, you know, what is the potential level of exposure? And, you know, I think about it when I was a kid. I loved working with my parents in their garden, even when I was very little, but that was usually like for about a minute and a half at a time. I mean, you know, what's the chance of kids, young children in particular, spending an extraordinarily long period of time in these gardens as compared to other places they may be outdoors and spending more time?
Right. This is definitely an area where we need some more research. There aren't, in some cases, there definitely aren't good data that show how metals go from the soil into plants, and then more importantly, you know, what levels of exposure are we looking at with people? Are gardeners being exposed to levels that we should be concerned about? Are children being exposed to levels that we should be concerned about?
Right. So, and I guess the question really becomes, and we'll talk more about this in a couple of minutes, where some of your work down there at the Waste Management Institute is going to. You know, people are exposed to these materials all the time, and the real question becomes, I think, and we'll talk about this more, is having a garden, are you actually, in fact, exposing yourself more to these potential contaminants than you would be just normally sitting out in your backyard or playing catch in the backyard or whatever the case may be?
Exactly. As we talked about before, these are, in many cases, substances that are existing in the environment. And, you know, in New York State, for example, arsenic background concentrations are just levels that naturally occur. They exceed those levels that are set by the EPA for their screening levels for certain sites. So again, it depends on where you are and what circumstances you're dealing with.
So if I understood you, what you just said correctly, is that we need to clean up nature because nature has applied more arsenic in some situations than the EPA deems to be appropriate under certain circumstances.
That's actually the opposite message of what I was trying to get across, which is that, you know, everything has risks, everything has benefits, and we really need to carefully think about all of the positive aspects of gardening.
Okay.
And not just focus on the potential for contaminants.
Okay, I'll tell you what we're going to do. Mike is telling me that we need to take a little bit of a break here. Why don't we go ahead and do that? When we come back, we, you know, sort of talked about the contaminants. What I want to do when we come back is talk about, okay, the potential exists. We know that there's benefits to gardening. How can we garden to reduce the potential risks as significantly as possible? And then also talk a little bit about where your future research is going as well as other resources that people can turn to. How does that sound?
That sounds great.
All right. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Weeders Digest on News Radio 570 WSYR.
News at every hour. News Radio 570 WSYR.
Now.com.
Welcome back to the Weeders Digest, a special edition of said programming. This is my opportunity every occasionally to explore some topics that are on my mind a little bit more in depth. And this morning, we are talking with Hannah Shaler. She's an extension associate with Cornell Waste Management Institute about potential heavy metal contaminants in urban gardening soils. And not just urban gardening soils. These materials exist everywhere. Lead, arsenic, cadmium, they are all naturally occurring elements. And so they can be found, in fact, in very rural settings as well. well, but we sort of set the stage before the commercial break talking about where these contaminants came from and what some of the concerns are. So, Hannah, now with about 7 minutes or so to go, let's talk about how people can reduce their risks for exposure to these materials while also enjoying all the benefits of gardening in urban settings.
That sounds great. That's really what we want people to focus on, is giving them the tools to being able to successfully manage their situations. And basically, what you can do is you want to just try to keep contaminated soil and soil dust away from people and plants as much as possible. This is especially important if you know that there's a problem, if you have tested your soils. If you have not tested your soils, luckily there are many easy, fairly inexpensive, common sense things that you can do anyway.
And those would include things like?
And some key things, gardening practices. You can be sure to be adding clean compost, topsoil, or other materials. You can make sure your soils aren't too acidic. Most metals are more likely to be taken up by plants in more acid soils.
Which, if I can interject for one moment, interestingly, at least in the immediate Syracuse area, in the city of Syracuse, the soils tend to be very alkaline. In fact, the soil in our backyard, when we lived on the north side of Syracuse, the pH was 8.4. And you consider neutral to be 7 and acidic to be anything below that. 8.4 is pretty alkaline because of the limestone escarpment. The hills south of Syracuse are basically a big hunk of limestone. They're very alkaline, and so all of the erosion that's occurred over all the years as water flows north towards Lake Ontario has laid down a layer of very alkaline material. And so many years ago when I worked for Cornell Cooperative Extension, we would get the results of hundreds of soil samples every year, and in the city of Syracuse, rarely did we find a soil sample where the pH was below about 7.5 or even 8. So that's a good thing, correct?
It is, and in some cases you may even want to look into adjusting your pH to more near neutral, but you can find lots of information about that at other gardening sites.
So that's one thing to keep in mind that it generally is a good thing, at least here in Central New York and in Syracuse, is that the soil pH is helping to make these materials less available to be taken up by plants.
Exactly.
All right. Next.
Yep, some other things you can do. You can carefully consider the conditions at your site, the things on it and around your garden. You could cover your bare soil with grass in areas where you're not planting crops, or you could mulch to reduce the dust. And again, those are things that'll just help with site management and make things look nice in general. You want to think about where you're placing your garden. It's better to not grow your garden right next to buildings or roads. For lead especially, much of the lead in soils comes from old lead paint that's breaking down and ending up in the soil, and also from the remains of flooded gasoline that was phased out many years ago but still persists in the environment. If you think that you might have higher levels of contamination, building raised beds is one thing that is especially helpful, especially if you put in some landscape fabric and block off the clean soil that you're bringing in from the existing soil. That can give you a fresh start so that you can grow things in clean soil, even though the site itself might have some problems.
Okay.
Similarly, you can also consider which crops you're going to grow. Things like fruiting crops tend to have lower levels of metals than leafy greens, as I talked about, that can get lots of dust on them.
And that is, so things like beans, tomatoes, peppers, things like that would mm-hmm. tend to be less of an accumulator.
Exactly. There are more barriers for metals to get into the fruiting part of a plant.
Okay.
You'd be less likely to have metal in the part that you're actually eating.
Okay.
And, whereas something like a root crop, such as a carrot or potato, you want to be careful about growing that in soils that may have higher levels of lead or arsenic or any other metal.
Okay. Now, but that, at the same time, doesn't necessarily mean don't grow them. It means potentially just make sure you clean them thoroughly, peel them, and so forth.
Exactly. Yep. Peeling root crops is one thing that you can do. And also, as I said before, washing those leafy greens and your herbs really well. A solution of a little bit of vinegar can help with that.
Okay. And in fact, I just just want to refer back as we're going through this, one of the links that'll be on the show's website, a lot of this information is in the publication Soil Contaminants and Best Practices for Healthy Gardens, and there'll be a link to that. You can download that right from the Waste Management Institute website. Continue on. I didn't mean to interrupt. I just wanted to remind people.
No, that's perfect. We talk about all this in much more detail in that document, so that's great.
Okay.
And there's also just some other very basic common sense things you can do, like washing your hands well after you've been working in the garden, watching your children carefully to be sure they're not consuming the soil, and trying to keep soil from coming indoors on your shoes or your pets or your clothing.
Okay, so just some general sanitary practices.
Exactly.
Instead of traipsing that mud right through the kitchen, you know.
Exactly.
As my mother always said, were you raised in a barn? So, okay, let's do this. We've got just about a minute and a half or so left. What are some of the things that you're exploring down there, and what kind of information might we find coming out of the Waste Management Institute in the future on this topic?
Well, we're lucky that we have lots of people throughout the state that we're working with, and really I'd say that we're trying to tackle two big questions. And the first is, what do things really look like? What levels are out there in soils, and more importantly, in the produce that people are eating? And then from that, what can people do? So we really need to have better information about the levels of exposure that are out there and the situations that people are dealing with, but then we want them to be able to have effective management strategies. As I emphasized at the beginning, gardening is a really important activity. It's part of people's culture. It's part of, people grew up doing things certain ways, and we really want whatever management recommendations we come up with and whatever information we're providing to fit with what people know to do and what they'd like to do. And so far it seems like there's going to be a really good match between the things that we're recommending and what works well in gardens. But we want to have more information so that we can provide science-based recommendations to people.
Very good. Hannah, I want to thank you very much for taking some time with us today to talk about a topic that's been in the news lately and maybe providing a little bit more balanced perspective in what the issues are and the kind of things people can do to still enjoy gardening in their urban gardens and as urban agriculture takes hold as well. I really appreciate it. I want to remind everyone that we will be adding additional information on the Weeders Digest blog so that you can click on some links and download some of this information as well as other information that's available as well. And Hannah will look forward to talking with you again in the future. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
All right. We need to take a break. You are listening to the Weeders Digest on News Radio 570 WSYR. Welcome back to the Weeders Digest, and just as a little bit of a reminder, we're doing things a little bit differently today. Every occasionally, I take the opportunity to spend some extended amount of time talking about some of the things that I find to be interesting, and I hope that you find to be interesting as well. So we're not taking calls today, but we just a little bit ago talked with Hannah Shaler, an extension associate with the Cornell Waste Management Institute, about the topic of heavy metal contaminants, potential heavy metal contaminants in urban garden soils and how to address those. Now, we are going to talk about my absolutely number one favorite horticultural event in the entire universe, which is coming up about a month and a half from now. It's the last weekend in July every year. It's called Garden Walk Buffalo. And joining me is Jim Charlier. Hey, Jim, did I pronounce that right?
Yes, you pronounced Buffalo correctly, yes.
Your last name's always a little tricky for me. But anyway, I get tongue-tied when I start talking about Garden Walk Buffalo because it is just absolutely phenomenal and only getting even more phenomenal every year because this year, if I understand correctly, you have over 300 gardens involved?
Yeah, last year we had about 310. This year we have about 330.
And I can say from personal experience, even racing as fast as I could possibly race, I couldn't even remotely come close to seeing every single garden. So our strategy now, every year we come over to this now, and we go to a different neighborhood. So let's real quickly lay some of the groundwork. Give us the bare essence of what Garden Walk Buffalo is, and then we'll get into some of the more specifics as far as how people can enjoy it and all that kind of stuff and some of the new things people might see this year.
Yeah. Now, the walk itself is it's about 330 gardens, and it's over about three, maybe four square miles. And there's some great, it's all great residential gardens. There's a few nonprofits and a couple businesses, but it's more than 300 of them are residential urban gardens. Many are in little clusters in neighborhoods, so you can actually see a lot of gardens just with going to a couple different sections. But there are some spectacular gardens that are in what we say outlying areas, which might be two blocks away from the clusters of gardens. But you're going to see everything from vegetable gardens are big this year, Victorian gardens, Japanese, Asian-inspired gardens, cottage gardens, English style, anything you can think of you would see here.
And I can second that. You know, interestingly, you mentioned vegetable gardens being more popular this year. So this is a perfect example and ties in perfectly with the conversation that we just had with Hannah Schuyler from the Waste Management Institute about how to go about implementing and having vegetable gardens and edible gardens in urban settings. And so by going to Garden Walk Buffalo, you can see not only functional examples of urban vegetable gardening, but also extraordinarily beautiful examples as well on how you can incorporate that very aesthetically into an urban setting.
Yeah, we've got everything from, I've got a little, a mini French potager garden, but there's also a chef on, there's a couple chefs who are on Garden Walk. One has a vegetable garden in his front yard, including corn.
Oh.
These are urban gardens, so it would be facing the street and sidewalk. And also, there's another chef who has a great urban garden and usually invites a Garden Walk to attend a function at the Albright Knox Art Gallery where he will prepare stuff with things from his own garden.
Wow, very cool. And, you know, I think this is a thing, you know, just to mention as well, for people that have not been to Buffalo in a long time, or maybe never been to Buffalo, and all they know about Buffalo is all the nasty stuff they read in the papers and so forth. From personal experience, I can tell everyone that to this day, anyone that thinks that Buffalo is dead and dying and gone is so misinformed, it's almost silly, because these neighborhoods are absolute. People would die to live in these neighborhoods. They are so attractive and so vibrant. It is. I cannot gush enough about this. So let's talk a little bit about some of the nitty-gritty. How can people get more information? What would you offer as a strategy for making the weekend as enjoyable as possible as far as getting from point A to point B and all of those kind of nitty-gritty details?
Yeah, the first thing would be check out the website, www.gardenwalkbuffalo.com. There in mid-July, you should be able to pick up a map of where all the gardens are.
So you can download that from the website.
Yep, and that's all free.
Okay.
And you'll just get the map. You won't get the descriptions of the gardens. For that, you have to get our printed map, which will be available at the three different headquarters. So when you come in on Saturday and Sunday, July 25th and 26th, from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., you can head to one of our three different headquarters we have spread throughout this three or four square mile area, and you can pick up a free map. You can purchase some Garden Walk merchandise, this year's poster, and so on. But the maps are free, and you can strategize what neighborhood you'd like to hit to see the most gardens. There's a feature on the map where if you're looking to see specific things like vegetable gardens or ponds or Asian-influenced gardens, there will be a list by garden type there. There will also be shuttle buses going around. On Saturday, there will be one bus. On Sunday, there will be three buses. So you could actually just park your car and rely on the free shuttle bus to get around to the different neighborhoods.
And so the buses obviously are going to be circulating all the time, so you can just get off wherever you want, get back on, and head off and say, okay, this looks interesting, we'll get off here for a while.
Exactly.
Wonderful. And again, you know, this is one thing I can speak from personal experience. If you just even get remotely close to the neighborhoods, you know, there's plenty of parking along the streets. We've never had a way, and that's literally what we do, is we just find an open spot on one of the side streets, park the cars. We've never had any problem with any kind of break-ins or, you know, anything like that. So, you know, don't assume that if you park along a street in Buffalo that you're going to get mugged and all that kind of stuff, because it's not going to happen.
No. We've been doing this for 15 years. There's not been a single incident. The worst complaints we get is a couple of gardeners have said that their grass gets worn.
I hate when that happens.
Yeah. It grows.
Yeah, right, exactly. You know, the other cool thing that last year we were sort of up towards up around the Art Museum. What's the boulevard there that has the farmer's market on it?
That's Bidwell Parkway. There's a farmer's market on Saturday, and one of our headquarters is just a short walk up the street from that, as well as across from the headquarters we're going to have many area nonprofits and plant societies, the Daylily Society, the Rose Society, and some other green Buffalo Niagara River Keepers groups giving out information and answering questions for the visitors.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, last year I strolled the farmer's market, and that in and of itself was very interesting. And then you go about a block, and the cross street there with the boulevard is, what is, would that be? Is that not, that's not Delaware, is it?
No, the main street there is Elmwood Ave. That's where all the boutiques and shops.
Right. Oh, yeah. And that in and of itself, I mean, you can stop, get something to eat. It could not be better organized in that manner.
Yeah, Elmwood is sort of the spine for the entire event.
So, you know, you're sort of go through all the cross streets. If you just sort of focus on Elmwood Avenue, which, again, is not difficult to get to at all when you're heading to Buffalo or head into Buffalo. Let's see, what do we still need to cover now? Down at the marina, are they still doing this year the flower varieties and so forth?
Yeah, the Erie Basin Marina, which is a beautiful park to begin with, right on Lake Erie, a beautiful vista of the lake and the windmills down in the south towns, and a great view of downtown Buffalo, the skyline. And that's where the marina is, where all the beautiful boats are. We have the Erie Basin Marina University Trial Garden, which is where a lot of the seed companies have us test their seeds 2 or 3 years before they reach the market. So you'd be able to go down there and take a look at what will be coming out, different varieties and colors of plants. And they even suggest that Garden Walk visitors get to flag their favorite of these different plants. And that information actually goes right back to the seed distributors to let them know what were the most popular plants. And that's input for what they will end up marketing.
Very good. Well, Jim, we're just about out of time. I have to be honest. I hate to rush summer along, but I can hardly wait for the last weekend in July, because Beth and I will definitely be there again. We're going to work out to, you know, make sure that we can sustain ourselves to make as many gardens as possible. The event is Garden Walk Buffalo. It is Saturday and Sunday, July 25th and 26th, from 10 in the morning till 4 in the afternoon. For more information, you can go directly to Garden Walk Buffalo. That is all one word, .com. And there's a whole bunch of information there. And or you can also just go to the Weeders Digest blog at 570WSYR.com. Click on shows. Click on the Weeders Digest. And I'll have some pictures from past Garden Walk Buffalo events that Beth and I have attended. And we maybe will have a chance to talk to you real briefly as maybe the weekend before the big event, just to remind people again to make the trip over to Buffalo.
That would be great. I appreciate it.
Have a great weekend. Thanks for joining us, Jim.
Thank you.
All right. Let's take our last break of the morning. Don't go away, though. When we come back, we're going to be joined by Dr. Brenda Nordstrom to talk about sort of the perception of risks associated with gardening. I know that sounds a little bit weird, but stay tuned, and I think it'll all make sense in just a couple of minutes. You're listening to the Weeders Digest on News Radio 570 WSYR.
Our children will always.
Welcome back to Weeders Digest. Just a quick reminder, we're doing things a little bit differently today. We're talking about about a series of topics that I find personally to be very interesting, and I hope you find them to be interesting too. A little bit of a reminder, we had Hannah Shaler, who's an extension associate with the Cornell Waste Management Institute, with us earlier in the program talking about the issue of heavy metal contaminants in urban soils as it relates to vegetable gardening and gardening in general. Then we talked with Jim Charlet, who represents Buffalo, or I should say Garden Walk Buffalo, and that tremendous public urban garden tour that comes up right at the end of July. That's the last weekend in July, and we'll talk more about that. And now, we're saving the best for last. We're talking with Dr. Brenda Nordenstam, who is an associate professor in the Department of Environmental Studies at the SUNY College of Environmental Science and Forestry. Good morning, Brenda. How are you?
I'm fine, Terry. How are you?
I'm very well. I think I pronounced the name fairly correctly.
Yes, you got very close.
Okay. All right. Well, you know, your specialty is, I guess, and correct me if I'm wrong, is really sort of risk perception and sort of taking a look at environmental and public health hazards and risks associated with those and putting that all into perspective, correct?
Yes, that's a pretty good, very close, actually.
Well, I took that from your website, so I'm assuming that's somewhat accurate anyway. When we talked the other day, you had mentioned that you have just finished up some work on a very interesting topic, particularly a timely topic, right here in Onondaga County, because the county executive has chosen to try to move towards more of a green infrastructure strategy for dealing with stormwater runoff and the whole issue of combined storm and sanitary sewer overflows. And with that, why don't you go ahead and explain what you were exploring, why you were exploring it, and some of the things that you're seeing from that work.
All right. What we did was we did a survey and looked at public perception of alternative green infrastructure measures for stormwater runoff. And by alternative green infrastructure measures, we are talking about rain barrels, rain gardens, trees, porous pavement, and curbside extensions. And that's what we were interested in because that's something that's going to impact citizens directly. They'll have to really take ownership of some of those implementations if it's going to be successful.
Okay, now let's stop right there. Let's refresh everyone's memory as far as how the original proposal and the way many communities have dealt with this issue of combined storm and sanitary sewer circumstances, which is very common throughout the Northeast, is building these big, large-scale treatment plants like they have in Midland Avenue in the city, like they were doing in the trolley parking lot in Armory Square, and so they were taking these very large, centralized, massively expensive and disruptive strategies, and instead decentralizing them out into the community. Is that an accurate sort of setting the stage of accurate portrayal?
Yes, that's fairly close. The idea is decentralization results in lower impacts, lower environmental impacts, and also avoids the huge cost that the taxpayers would take on.
But as you were just mentioning, by decentralizing it, it means that individuals now are going to bear some of the responsibility and the cost directly associated with making these decentralized sort of softer environmental practices.
Yes, unless there's incentives of some sort, then the idea is that the citizens would be, you know, going out and buying or making the rain barrels and then maintaining them, and likewise with establishing rain gardens. Some of the things they might would not be directly, they would not have to do, perhaps, like curbside extensions is something the city itself would probably do.
Right. Yeah, well, can you explain what those curbside extensions are? I'm not even exactly clear what they are.
Well, it's periodically along a street. There would be an extension of the curbside, and essentially better drainage would be put in, and often tree boxes might be planted there in that curbside extension. And the idea is, once again, this would absorb and take care of some of the rainwater runoff that now just goes directly out into the street and across and or across the street and contaminates the street and brings in contaminants. So that was the idea of curbside extensions. And that does result in the loss of parking wherever those extensions are put in.
Would that be similar to some of the work they've done, like in Portland, Oregon, where you'd have these bump outs in the street?
Yes, it would.
And actually, that, to me, not that we're getting into engineering here, but that makes absolutely no sense to me. Because we have this thing, it's called snow during the winter, and trying to plow around these things, it would be very interesting to see how they would implement that in a lot of areas. But anyway, regardless, that's a whole other conversation. So let's talk about some of the things that some of the data you collected, and have you actually analyzed the data yet? What are your thoughts as far as what you're finding as part of this work?
Well, we have analyzed some of the data, and there is quite a bit of support if these green infrastructure measures were free. If they were provided free, the rain barrels is about 70% support for rain barrels and about 75% for rain gardens and for trees. So that's not looking at the cost of maintenance, but simply providing it to them. So you could say roughly 25% of the people do have support if it is free to start with.
So this gets back to the old-time issue of people basically want their cake and want to eat it too. You know, they don't want to spend tax dollars to build this massive infrastructure, and at the same time, they don't want to take responsibility financially for the runoff coming off of their own property. Is that a fair interpretation, potentially?
Probably. I mean, you might say that some of them perhaps couldn't take it financially. I mean, perhaps they're being realistic in saying, I know I couldn't afford
$75 for a rain barrel.
Yeah, and in some cases, that might be the case, that we did some of this specifically in lower income communities.
Right.
And so that possibly could be the case, or perhaps, and this is a part we haven't looked at yet, perhaps there are other aspects that, in terms of, by age, in terms of thinking whether or not they could actually handle the rain barrel or the rain garden on a continuous basis. So there could be other factors, and that will be interesting when we start to look at that.
A very good point. Obviously, in the city of Syracuse, we have somewhat of an aging population who struggle to maintain the homes that they've maybe been in for 50 years as it is. And then to add this on top of that, they, like you say, they're simply being realistic and saying, we're 85 years old and we just can't do that.
Yeah, and that definitely might be a possibility, and in which case would require further planning in order to implement it successfully across the neighborhoods that the city hopes to do this in.
Very good. Well, it is an interesting thing. Of course, everyone was very excited when the county executive decided to go towards this more decentralized thing, but your research is definitely indicating that it's not necessarily a bad idea. It's just not necessarily as cut and dried and straightforward and easy to do as we might anticipate, regardless that the technology, the rain barrel technology, obviously, is not high-tech. Gardens are not extraordinarily high-tech, and there's all sorts of information that exists. The curb bump-outs have been done in other communities, so all the technology exists. It's more, like you say, this is something no one's ever really looked at, is what's the sociological impact of actually implementing some of these things.
Yeah, I think it's like a lot of the major programs that the government has implemented. It takes time, whether it's recycling or weatherization. It takes time to sort of diffuse that information and technology. And I think that even though it's a great idea, there has to be a bit of caution in proceeding forward so that it is successful.
Very good. Brenda, we're out of time. I want to thank you very much for taking some time with us this morning. And, you know, I think we're definitely, we've not heard the last of this because there's going to be things going forward here in Onondaga County and Central New York and across the country that your research definitely directly impacts. Thank you very much. Have a wonderful weekend. And with that, we are out of time. I want to remind everyone, make sure you go to 570WSYR.com, click on shows, click on the Reader's Digest, and I'll have links to information on all of what you've listened to this morning. Until next week, have a great and very safe weekend. You've been listening to the Reader's Digest on News Radio 570 WSYR.
I had a great idea.